Hello, welcome to The Wire, where fresh coverage of independent news and current affairs from right around Australia comes to you on your local community radio station. I'm Roderick Chambers in Sydney, and coming up on the program today...
We think it may be driven by the cost of living crisis and having a younger demographic in those areas.
There is an epidemic of loneliness, according to the Australian Unity Wellbeing Index, which is a survey that's just been taken recently. And we take a look at how Australians are feeling about their lives and where they are living. So stay tuned for more here on The Wire. But first, after years of criticism for Australia's family law system, which leaves children in the dark, recent reports highlight children's trauma in family proceedings. The Federal Court and Family Court of Australia has launched a new Children's Charter and Kids Corner website. Susan Hu asked the National Children's Commissioner, Anne Hollands, what are the new resources that are put in place and how do they aim to make family law more child-centred and rights-based?
Recently, the Family Court launched what's called the Children's Charter, which is a set of promises that the court makes to children about how they will respect their rights, their dignity and respect in the processes at the court. And the Kids Corner website is a set of resources available online for children whose families are going through the family court processes so that children can be informed about what's happening and also to understand how they can be involved and the help that they can get through the court.
So how significant is this step in making Australia's family law system more consistent with our UN Convention on the Rights of the Child obligations?
Both of these initiatives are very significant and really show that the Family Court is providing leadership across the country for how to put children at the centre and to uphold the human rights of children as we're required to do under our obligations for the Convention on the Rights of the Child. You know, children whose families go through court processes, you know, their lives are deeply affected by the decisions that are made by the judge, and yet under the law they're not allowed to be involved in the actual hearings as such. They're kept outside the hearing room, but there are other ways that children, you know, their needs can be addressed. And what the court is trying to do is to really reach out to ensure that they're doing everything they can to look after the needs of children, which is a really great thing.
So we know the initiatives respond to recent criticisms and reports. What were the main problems highlighted in these reports about children's experiences?
So there's been a number of research reports over the past few years that have highlighted that children really feel that they're being kept in the dark, while others, like the judge, are making decisions that affect every aspect of their lives. You know, this is something that has caused children a lot of distress. It made them feel really ignored and abandoned by the systems around them. We know that it's been a negative for their mental health and their well-being. I guess that's really motivated action to try to better address the needs of children. You know, I think it's important to understand that systems like the family law system are designed for adults. It was never envisaged that they would meet the needs of children. That's not how these systems have been set up. And in fact, if we started again with a blank page and developed a family law system that did put children at the centre, it would look completely different. So what we're doing now is retrofitting an old system that is all about the adults. And I think it's hard to do, it's complex, but I applaud the Family Court for the steps that they're taking in that regard.
Yes, you've talked about complexity, and family psychologists have pointed out time pressures, funding limits, and adversarial legal structures make it difficult to keep children's needs at the center. How do these new reforms tackle those deeper challenges, or are there more changes needed?
Well, I think these resources are a very important step in that the court is making promises to children to involve them more, to respect their rights to have a say and to be informed about what's happening. And this is all about their human rights, which is what dignity and respect is all about. It's about recognising their rights as humans to be involved in matters that are affecting them. I think we need to do more. We need to really assess what are the other steps we need to take and whether the court processes themselves and the Family Law Act, the way it's structured at the moment, largely to exclude the involvement of children. I mean, we really struggle to bring their voices in. We don't really see children being directly represented, for example, in these hearings. They are indirectly listened to by independent children's lawyers who are doing a service for the court, not for the children. And that's in contrast to other legal settings where children are able to get their own legal representation. These are some of the, live and contentious issues that are being discussed now. And I think we need to keep going. We need to, as I said, recognise that the system as a whole is not set up for children. And we also need to recognise that there's a long history of thinking that says children should be seen and not heard. And the way to protect children is to keep them out of these disputes between their parents. That's actually protective. But I think more and more research, more and more evidence has been pointing to the fact that children who are silenced and are kept in the dark, they're not protected.
Anne Hollins, the National Children's Commissioner, speaking there with Susan Hu.
Hey there, I'm Hamish McDonald. Around Australia, you're listening to The Wire. Take it easy.
A survey called the Australian Unity Wellbeing Index has found that people have greater satisfaction with life than in previous years. However, beneath this positive outlook, not everyone shares the same sense of optimism, and this is an issue which has been brought to the attention of policymakers. Thomas Kudus asked Dr. Kate Lysett, Senior Research Fellow at the School of Psychology at Deakin University, just what factors mostly influence these differences.
So different patterns on personal well-being, so that's satisfaction with people's life across seven areas such as standard living and health and personal relationships. So we saw a different pattern on personal well-being compared to national well-being. Across both of the measures, we saw that things that really made a difference were affluence, so areas, geographic areas that had higher income, less unemployment, for instance, actually had higher levels of well-being on both measures. So that was a big difference.
Were there any findings in your study that surprised you, perhaps regions that scored unexpectedly high or low in well-being?
Yeah, absolutely. We were very surprised to see the city of Melbourne, so the electorate of Melbourne, and scoring low on personal well-being. They're areas traditionally that, you know, kind of the heart of cities and so much culture and things like that. But when we've looked at the demographics in those electorates, we think it may be driven by the cost of living crisis and having a younger demographic in those areas. The other thing that was quite good to see, in rural areas, they actually had the strongest satisfaction with their personal relationships, their community connectedness, so that was really nice. So that we could see playing out. The other thing that surprised us was the stark divide on the National Wellbeing Index between cities, so capital cities, and everywhere else. So that index looks at satisfaction with the economy, government, the natural environment, social conditions, business and national security, so those six areas. And in the regions, people are not satisfied with life in Australia across those areas, whereas people in the cities are very satisfied. So we can see there's a bit of a disconnect going on there, and that stark divide was more surprised, like that surprised us. It was much sharper than I expected.
And how can governments use wellbeing data to better support communities and especially those outside major metropolitan areas?
One of the reasons we went down to the electorate level was because this can give the community the information they need for community change, but also because we know community action can make such a big difference, but also so their members of parliament can represent them and try and bring about change at the policy level, because some of these changes that we need actually need government and policy intervention to make a difference. Right now, Australia has Measuring What Matters, which is a dashboard of measures that Treasury runs, which is terrific to see. And the reason for this is to measure things beyond economic growth, to actually say, well, it really matters how people are feeling about their lives. It matters how equitable our society is and sustainable Australia. So that's great to see. But right now it's sitting there being measured, but it's not actually impetus for politicians or policymakers to make decisions based on it. Because we know that economic growth that is for the sake of, you know, growing, that's unsustainable and not equitable for all Australians, isn't a good way to be progressing as a society. And I think if we make policy decisions and put people and planet at the heart, people and planet, the well-being of our people at the heart of these decisions, that could make a really big difference.
So you said that that these issues need to be in the centre for policymakers. Do you believe that well-being should be a central measure of national progress? And what I mean is alongside traditional economic indicators like the GDP.
I would love to see that. And we know other countries around the world are doing that. There's no, absolutely, we need to have those indicators. We need things like GDP and productivity. They're needed, but they're needed in terms of actually other measures alongside that to say, well, actually, are these things being distributed evenly? If we have high GDP, are people feeling that GDP? Are we doing it at the cost of our planet, or are we creating a more equitable and sustainable Australia? So I absolutely think we need to be measuring these things all together. And when we make the decisions, they need to consider the well-being of people and planet, not just economic growth for the sake of growth.
Dr. Kate Lysett, Senior Research Fellow at the School of Psychology, Deakin University, speaking there with Thomas Kutas. Many people have been promoting the idea of a dopamine detox, where we avoid sugary foods, games, online exciting activities, and therefore help reduce our reliance on a constant need for excitement. But you can't just simply stop the brain using dopamine. Dopamine is not only something that gives us a pleasant feeling as a reward, it is a vital brain chemical that helps us stay focused and maintain motivation. Nelson Scott asked Dr. Anastasia Hironas, clinical psychologist and author of The Dopamine Brain, to explain what people are trying to achieve with a dopamine detox.
So a dopamine detox has typically been sold as this short-term solution for kind of resetting our you know, brain chemicals and pathways. Usually people are looking at doing something like a 24-hour detox where they stop doing anything that's going to sort of stimulate dopamine in their brain. So that's, you know, no TV, no Netflix, no sugary food, no music, no fun, basically, for 24 hours. And the idea being that this can kind of reset our levels, but ultimately not as effective as we would like to think it might be. It's probably going to feel like a pretty uncomfortable 24 hours. We will have some sort of withdrawal effect, but it's not long enough to see any lasting change.
But you can't actually detox from dopamine, can you?
You can't detox from dopamine itself. You know, we need dopamine. It's always kind of running in our brain and body, and it does a lot more than just kind of create that feeling of pleasure. It helps regulate our kidney functions. It helps us store memories in the brain. It helps control our motor movements. So it actually does a fair bit beyond just kind of creating that feeling of pleasure. So we absolutely need it in order to be functioning.
How does social media and many of the other similar distractions we encounter in the modern world impact how dopamine functions within our brains?
Yeah, so what we see is through things like social media or screens, we get these very constant sort of low-level experiences of dopamine being activated. And the thing is that our brain likes to kind of have a sense of baseline and to calibrate itself so that it's not always feeling excited all the time. So if we get this constant dopamine activation through screens and other things in life, what that then means is that when we then go out and meet our friends for a coffee or do something kind of more natural that would usually activate dopamine pathways, it doesn't necessarily feel as good because we've already had it activated artificially through other things in our life.
Is this overstimulation and having this dopamine rushing, like seeking instant pleasure all the time, is that potentially a factor underpinning the surge in ADHD diagnoses we've seen?
Well, definitely this kind of move towards short-term, shorter-form content and a move away from kind of long-form content through YouTube Shorts and Reels and things like that. There are links. It's not sort of been proven as of yet, but there's certainly emerging research that shows that there are links to increases in the ADHD diagnoses or difficulties with attention that we're seeing, because dopamine's not only activated when we experience something pleasurable, but it also keeps pulling us in that direction. If anyone's ever kind of felt an urge to do something, an urge to check their phone, an urge to eat a sugary treat, for example, that's dopamine pulling you in that direction, which makes it harder for us to focus on long-form content.
It's interesting because one of the best predictors of success that I've observed is the ability of people to think in the long term. Is there a way of channeling dopamine and resetting the brain's settings, in a sense, to be able to do that?
Yes, we can do almost like a longer form of a dopamine detox, digital detox, but in a more moderated way. Whenever we do something quite intensely for a short period of time, it's unlikely to have lasting effects. But essentially what we do encourage people to do is look at re-examining their relationship with certain things in life, whether that is the phone, social media, video games, whatever it might be that's a source of artificial dopamine activation for them, looking at sort of taking a break from those things. But that really needs to be kind of a couple of weeks in order for it to have a longer lasting impact. And then at the end of that period of time, getting people to reconsider, okay, what do I want my relationship with social media or video games, etc., to look like going forward?
You write that dopamine is central to learning and goal setting, not something we should fear or suppress. Do you think this cultural obsession with detoxing might actually make us more anxious or unproductive?
Yes, I think also we've got a bit of a culture of kind of looking for like quick fixes to things and immediate answers. And unfortunately, the brain is so much more complex than that, and you know, this kind of simplicity of something like a detox that can happen quite quickly and easily. But absolutely, the brain is essential for helping us store memories, process learning. Back in the days of the caveman, we had dopamine to help us do hard things, to help us hunt for food and, you know, survive essentially. But the problem is that in this day and age, we can get dopamine activated without having to work for it.
Yeah, it's such an interesting thing, isn't it, that relationship between pleasure and long-term satisfaction and how easy it is to be sucked in, and that kind of empty feeling that one gets after looking at reels all day. Is it a similar sort of sensation that, like, scrolling Instagram and reels to what one would get playing the pokies, in a sense? You're just looking for that next hit?
It's almost exactly the same. It's very, very similar. The mechanisms that are at play, both in the brain, but also in terms of how the devices operate, are very similar.
Dr. Anastasia Hironas, clinical psychologist and author of The Dopamine Brain, speaking there with Nelson Scott.
Whenever I want to catch up with current affairs in Australia, I head to thewire.org.au or I follow them on Twitter. I just search for The Wire Radio, all one word. And yes, they're on Facebook too.
Russian films have a proud history of storytelling, with the likes of Andrei Tarkovsky, Sergei Eisenstein and Sergei Bondarchuk having a global influence on the medium. After a brief fertile post-Soviet period where restrictions on artistic expression were lifted, Russia's drift back to authoritarianism has seen the state again aim to obtain a monopoly over the means of expression. Following the invasion of Ukraine, Stephen Hill asked Dr. Greg Dolgopolov, Associate Director of the Russian Resurrection Film Festival, what is the current state of Russian film and how has it been affected by the 2022 national security laws?
Russian cinema has predominantly chosen to occupy safe topics, and those safe topics tend to be things from the past. So folklore is safe, history is safe, resurrecting hits from the Soviet era is also safe.
Can you tell us a little bit about the films that the Russian film industry has produced that focus on the Russian invasion?
There's no films that have addressed the war in Ukraine that attract any sort of audience. And the ones that were made as propaganda films with state money behind them, in order to promote positive feelings about the war, have seriously bombed at the box office to the point that they're just screened on TV and then promoted as having done extraordinarily well, but no one actually watches them. So there's zero appetite for any war theme. I mean, audiences are smart enough to make these kind of interpretations. There's, for example, there's a really popular film that's done really well at the box office about the Mongol invasion. And that film could be seen in multiple ways. That you could see it a great Ukrainian resistance against the hordes, or a patriotic Russian tale. So people will probably see it in different ways. And I think that that kind of return back to the Soviet era of reading between the lines hasn't gone away. If anything, it's back in force.
I believe one of the most successful films at the moment is an adaptation of Mikhail Bulgakov's very subversive The Master and the Margarita.
I'd say the most popular, critically acclaimed film of the last couple of years was Master Margarita, an American guy who moved to Russia as a kid. He's gone backward forwards between the states. Anyway, he made a classic, you know, adaptation of 20th century literary classic, but it is the best adaptation that we've got. You know, and there's been multi-episodic adaptations of it. This is, you know, an extraordinary adaptation which works as both a kind of auteur cinema. It is, you know, artsy, but also so mainstream, exceptionally well made, and very critical. You don't need to read very much between the lines to see that it's a critique of the dictatorship that's happening in the Kremlin and all the evils that are happening. The state tried to take it down. They tried to sort of, you know, control which cinemas it played in, but, you know, kind of the market ruled, and it's been very popular. People have gone to see it. People have spoken about it, and it's kind of, you know, circumvented those rules. Those films like Master and Margarita, or even those folk tales, they can be interpreted in so many different ways. And it's really also what happens outside of the kind of main discourse, what you know, sort of memes that are emerging, that kind of digital culture is emerging around those films, because, you know, audiences are, you know, they're cautious about what they say on social media, but you're also seeing on Telegram and Signal the types of things people are saying, where they know they're you know, only partially being monitored, and how they ridicule both propaganda and, you know, find meaning in between the lines and do quick memed reinterpretations of mainstream films to give them a different angle. You know, unlike the Stalin period, the state's got no chance of having full control over what people think, let alone what they say and express.
So what's the story about Russian creative talent? There certainly are several major Russian filmmakers that have migrated out of the country.
There's a lot of directors who've been shut down, a lot of actors who've spoken out against the war, who are not getting the same sort of opportunities that they were previously. So big movie stars have either emigrated or gone abroad for long-term projects to either work in theatre or do other things. And there's very few actors, maybe Yuri Borisov, the guy who won the best supporting actor in Anora.
Oh, yes.
Stands out in the sense that he hasn't criticised the state and has continued working in Russia and clearly with Anora overseas and occupies that kind of, you know, interesting, you know, middle ground. But most actors have defined their position, and some have gone, some have fallen silent or are not getting work, and therefore I wonder how they're surviving.
So what's the situation like in Ukraine when it comes to filmmaking?
What's really so crazy, and this I think we need to talk about this, is how functional the cinemas are across Ukraine. We wouldn't be ashamed of going to a cinema in Ukraine because they've got full programming, and there's a pretty good balance between locally made films and Western films, which is just kind of like remarkable that at a time of war, then wars rage for 3 years, you could have film production that is at a reasonably high level, that, you know, you wouldn't be ashamed seeing any of these films.
Dr. Greg Dolgopolov, Senior Lecturer in Film and Associate Director of the Russian Resurrection Film Festival, speaking there with Stephen Hill. And that's it for The Wire today. You can find all of our stories online at thewire.org.au or subscribe to our podcasts. Just look for The Wire Radio. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2 SER 107.3 here in Sydney and broadcast around the nation on the Community Radio Network. In Sydney, The Wire is produced on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We're going to be back again tomorrow, so do tune in again then. I'm Roderick Chambers. Do stay well and thanks for your company.